From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
The Mission. Excelsior.
Redwood City.
American Canyon.
San Francisco.
Vallejo.
I'm from Redwood City, so I guess that's in the peninsula.
Coming up, we look at how social media is helping people find their stolen stuff.
So I go crazy on Twitter saying, like, hey, I found my bike. It's in Portland. If anybody knows anybody in Portland, like, let's spread the word and let's try to get it back.
Then we say hello to the new Exploratorium.
Don't worry, the heart of the old Exploratorium is still here.
And what's this sound and where is it from? You'll get your audiograph answer and more today on Cross Currents. National Bike to Work Day is coming up on May 9th. The San Francisco Bicycle Coalition says it will be ready when thousands of bicyclists take to the streets of the city. They'll have 25 Energizer stations set up around the city, with people cheering cyclists on and handing them drinks, snacks, and other goodies. Sounds like an awesome day to be had, unless your bike gets stolen. Less than 10% of stolen bikes are ever recovered. If you want yours to be one of them, it helps to have as much information as possible and as many pairs of eyes as you can wrangle. KALW's Isabel Angel has this story about how social media is turning ordinary citizens into ace bike detectives.
Jenny O'Hatfield is what you would call an avid cyclist. She's into mountain biking, indoor cycling, and road racing. She also happens to know a lot about social media from her work as an interactive producer at KQED. So when someone stole her brand new mountain bike from her Oakland home last summer, first she got upset. Then she sprang into action.
So I just kind of put together a description with a photo and disseminated it far and wide on the web. I emailed cycling groups, I posted it on Facebook, Google+, Twitter, Flickr, you name it. It's just blanketed the web and informed as many people as I could.
A week later, Jillian Betterly, who didn't know Hatfield but had seen her posts, recognized the bike at Oakland's Laney Flea Market. She went up to the guy selling it, showed him Hatfield's post on her phone,
and she just took it back. So I really lucked out in getting the bike back within a week.
Hatfield's stolen bike was found in a flea market. This is pretty common. Flea markets are a fairly unregulated and anonymous place to sell.
Is this bike for sale?
Yeah.
How much?
June Takeda goes to flea markets most weekends, including this one across from Laney College in Oakland. He looks for lots of things, old cameras, vintage audio equipment, and he's gotten especially good at spotting bikes.
If I know it's like a super rare bike or like a nice frame, and it's at a flea market, I mean, it's obviously stolen.
Takeda works in the cycling industry and owns 8 bikes. When he sees a bike he knows has been stolen, he'll buy it, take it home, and go online to try to get it back to its owner. Last year, he found a Davis Finney model Cerata at the Ashby Flea Market in Berkeley. It's a really rare bike that isn't made anymore.
Just walking through the flea market, and I saw it out of the corner of my eye. I knew exactly what it was when I saw it.
Dealers I called say that bike could be worth several thousand dollars. Takeda got it for $120. When he got home, he searched for a post about the bike on Craigslist and immediately found it. 2 hours later, owner and bike were reunited. The guy told Takeda it had been gone for about 6 months. Over the past year, Takeda's found and returned 3 bikes. He doesn't ask to be reimbursed, though sometimes grateful owners happily do so. Takeda figures it's good karma. Speaking of which, as we walk around, Takeda asks me if I've ever heard the story of Justin LeBeau.
So, I guess, you didn't talk to about the DeRosa frame, or? It's such a ridiculous story, especially since, like, everything on that bike is so rare.
I hadn't talked to Justin yet, but I had heard of his story from Jenny O'Hatfield.
He had a DeRosa track bike, a very rare, vintage, beautiful Italian track bike stolen 6 years ago. And he never lost hope that he would find it. He was always scanning, you know, cycling forums, Craigslist, eBay. And one day he got a lead that it had been surfaced up in Portland.
So At that point, I'm pretty confident, 100% confident that it's my bike, you know.
Ladies and gentlemen, Justin LeBeau.
So I go crazy on Twitter and every cycling forum that I am a member of, just saying like, hey, I found my bike. It's in Portland. If anybody knows anybody in Portland, like, let's spread the word and let's try to get it back.
This is when Hatfield gets involved. After she got her bike back, she kept using social media to help other people find theirs. She's also friends with LeBeau. So when she heard his story, she put the word out on Twitter.
Anyone in Portland want to help me recover a potentially stolen bike that's been missing for years?
She tweets at a Portland news anchor who's also a cyclist.
Have any contacts in Portland who could help recover a friend's stolen bike? He's 99% sure it's his.
Who loops in Portland's mayor, Sam Adams.
I don't, but I bet Joel does, or we could always appeal to Mayor Sam Adams about the bike thief.
By now, the bike has a huge Twitter following.
I hope your DeRosa will find her way home to you.
Portland, help. This story needs a happy ending.
They used to hang horse thieves, you know.
At one point, someone messages Hatfield directly with a lead.
FYI, one of my teammates spotted the bike in North Portland. Went to get a lock to keep it there, but it was gone.
They missed the bike that time, but more and more people are retweeting the news. A Portland police officer takes on the case, and that's when the original seller finally emails back Justin LeBeau with bad news.
He sold it to a guy, you know, this guy is, you know, just like some kind of vague description, like totally useless. But he did give me an email address.
LeBeau sends that email address, along with the original seller's email, to the Portland cop, who's able to put some pressure on them. The seller emails LeBeau, saying he'll give the bike back as long as the cops don't show up. So one of Jenny O. Hatfield's friends in Portland offers to go pick it up.
So Saturday morning, 9 a.m., he goes over there, rings the doorbell, no answer. And of course, like, we're all on the other end of this, like, on email and Twitter, like, did he get the bike? No, like, he won't answer the door.
Across the country, thousands of people wait, and an hour later, the door opens.
DeRosa found!
So many times, yeah, it was just, it was done. Like, the ad was down. It's done. We're never going to get it back. Or, you know, he's not going to respond to the email. You know, we should just give up. Yeah, I guess we got really lucky.
He was lucky. While there are other success stories, many more bikes are stolen than are ever returned to their owners.
You can see right there, January, I think I got, I don't know, that's 15 to 20 bikes right there.
In a warehouse near Jack London Square, Oakland police officer Dan Dowd is showing me where the police keep the bikes they do find. There are about 50 of them, all recovered in the last 3 months.
Yeah, you know, we've had people that come by and they just take a look at the bikes. You know, we have an open door here on Thursdays from 10 to noon, and people just kind of come over here and, you know, I got my bike stolen. I just let them look through the bikes and see. But again, very rarely do we. I don't think I've ever had one person in the approximately 10 years I've been doing this say, oh, that is my bike, you know. So we have, like I said, recovered a couple, but they were by serial number.
That's key, by serial number. Officer Dowd says there's no way for police to return a stolen bike without a serial number and the police report.
You should also take lots of photographs of your bicycle.
Again, Jenny O. Hatfield.
A lot of times when people email me on the Google groups, they don't have a picture, they don't have any sort of, you know, great description, and they're like, well, it's a red road bike and it had a basket on it.
Justin LeBeau has this to add.
The things that seem to have the best success are, you know, Craigslist, eBay, cycling forums, and, you know, I think social media as well. If you can find the right channels to broadcast the message, then I think people will pay attention.
And Jun Takeda has some pretty basic advice.
Best thing to do is just to not get it stolen in the first place.
Right. But if it is stolen, all the bike hunters say, keep looking. You might be surprised at what turns up. In Oakland, I'm Isabel Angel for Cross Currents. Thank you.
Have you been the victim of a bike theft? Did you ever get it back? Tell us about it. Use our social media. We tweet and Facebook at KALW. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Bikes are a common sight around San Francisco, and one of the most celebrated city experiences is biking across the Golden Gate. If you do that on a regular basis, you've surely noticed that there are no more toll-collecting officers on the bridge. Earlier this month, we spoke with Jackie Dean, who worked for 18 years in a Golden Gate Bridge toll booth.
I don't know how I'm getting through this. You know, I had an issue yesterday where one of my old-time customers came through, and she was so glad to see me. She wanted to see me before she left. And she looked at me, and I looked at her, and we both started bawling. She's holding my hand, and I just couldn't handle it. And I'm crying. I mean, I'm just full off. My shirt's wet. I'm crying. And then, you know, she leaves, and the next car is coming, and the husband's looking at me like I'm crazy. But the wife realizes what's happening, and she starts crying. He's looking at me, looking at his wife crying. And then he starts tearing up, and he was like, oh, my God, I can't deal with this. I can't deal with two women crying, one on each side of me. But they understood, and we didn't have to. I didn't have to verbalize anything. That bridge, it has an inner glow, and it's just totally, there's no other word but to say, but awesome. It's just like no other in the world.
After airing her story, we asked what you thought about the new toll system. Here's what some of you had to say.
I'm amazed at the disregard for new people and tourists on the bridge. The whole idea of having hospitality and treating your guests well just does not seem to enter the even greater profit motive of the people working or the bridge. And pity that we don't treat or see the need for people. I do.
I think it's a shame that when money has to be saved, humans are the first to be eliminated. I'd rather have my money go towards paying someone's salary and preserving a job they love, rather than going to support an increasingly cold, impersonal, technically run society, especially when so many are out of work and dealing with long-term unemployment. Thank you.
Those were listeners Graham Bell and Maggie Lawler. You too can comment on any story you hear on our show. Leave a message at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. If you rented a bike to cross the Golden Gate, you might return it to Fisherman's Wharf. Continue down the Embarcadero from there, and you'll reach Pier 15, where the Exploratorium had its grand reopening yesterday.
I believe that means that the Exploratorium is now open. Please come inside. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
The new waterfront space boasts 330,000 square feet of indoor and outdoor exhibits, including 150 that haven't been seen before. KALW's Nina Gensler-Debs was on site to say goodbye to the Exploratorium's former location at the Palace of Fine Arts, and she went to Pier 15 just a few weeks ago as San Francisco's beloved science museum prepared for its big unveiling.
With opening day just a few weeks out, the Exploratorium is all abuzz, literally.
Look at these gorgeous images that our expert microscopists have chosen for you today.
Our tour guide, Paul Doherty, is definitely excited. He walks us through the new space, pointing out both new and familiar elements of the museum.
Well, the heart of the Exploratorium is here. It's the machine shop. One thing about the Exploratorium is we build all of our exhibits here. Or, when we work with artists and residents, they become part of our culture as they build their art.
While it doesn't have the high ceilings of the old space, Pier 15 still has that unfinished, warehousey vibe. And it's much, much bigger. It spans the length of almost 3 football fields. And it's over the water, something that inspired many of the museum's new exhibits. For example, take this one about one of the bay's tiniest inhabitants, plankton.
They produce half the oxygen we breathe and absorb more carbon than all the forests on Earth.
Along the tour, we run into Jennifer Fraser, a cell biologist and co-curator of the East Gallery. She points to a blown-up image of plankton. It's luminous, like what you'd see out your airplane window when flying over a large city grid, twinkling in the dark of night.
They're really beautiful and stunning and surprising, and they're in every drop of water.
In addition to those images, there's a table-sized interactive display. Imagine a giant iPad that shows a colorful map of the world, tracking shifts in plankton population over time. It's beautiful to watch.
If you just looked at all these swirling ocean currents, you might think this was about sea surface temperature or other things about the ocean.
But if you use these special lenses, you can see microscopic organisms on different parts of the map.
And we made these lenses to show you that it's about microscopic life, the patterns of microscopic life.
There's another big screen in the museum that lets you see some of the bay's larger residents.
We're in front of an exhibit called Ship Tracker, which is a large screen, and on that screen you can see the location of all the ships outside the gate and inside the bay.
I find Ron Hipschman in the brand new Fisher Bay Observatory. He seems to do everything at the museum, but on his card he calls himself a quote-unquote loose cannon. The observatory is all glass and the only new building constructed at Pier 15.
All the ships transmit their location and identification information, so you can actually look at specific ships and find out where they're going, and we're also monitoring air quality, water quality, weather as well. Many, many factors that we'll be able to display here and talk about the local environment, and also we'll be able to relate that to a more global environment as well.
The museum's new location also includes 1.5 acres of the pier that will function as free outdoor space, complete with exhibits, a plaza, 2 restaurants, food carts, and, of course, views of the bay and the city. There, my tour guide, Paul Doherty, points out a footbridge that's one of the new art installations.
We'll have an installation by the artist Nakaya, which will envelop that bridge in fog. It's like 1,000 jets of fine mist that will just wrap it in fog. So as people come into the Exploratorium, they'll have the true San Francisco experience of walking through fog, even if it's a sunny day.
Actually, sunny days are pretty important to the Exploratorium. It will use solar power and bay water to heat and cool the building in an attempt to become the largest net zero energy museum in the country. There are a lot of big plans for this big museum that will only continue to expand. It bought Pier 17 for just that purpose. But Paul Doherty says that none of this will change what the museum has been and always will be, a place to learn, play, and explore.
Don't worry, the heart of the old Exploratorium is still here.
For Cross Currents, I'm Nina Gensler-Debs.
If you go to the Exploratorium, we'd like to hear what you think of the new digs. Also, snap some pictures and share them with us on Facebook or Twitter at KALW. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. And now, let's go back in time to when we played you this sound, about 5 minutes ago.
I believe that means that the Exploratorium is now open. Please come inside.
Well, there's actually a story behind that bell. This is a new one designed especially for the waterfront, and it's the only time it'll be played at the opening of the museum. For most of the last 44 years, the sound of a ringing bell has signaled the end of the day for visitors and staff. The museum's very first closing bell belonged to Exploratorium founder Frank Oppenheimer. It was a school bell that he brought out from his ranch in Colorado. After his death, Oppenheimer's son asked for the bell back, and the museum needed a new way to end the day. So, in 2006, composer Brenda Hutchinson bought a 250-pound cast iron bell from a collector in Michigan, hitched a trailer to the back of a car, and drove it out to its new home in California.
A lot of people would beep and wave and say, "Oh, you got the Liberty Bell." And I'm thinking, you haven't seen the Liberty Bell. It's, you know, it's huge.
When the Exploratorium shut its doors for the last time at its old location earlier this year, Brenda's bell was accompanied by a chorus of small handheld bells rung by Exploratorium visitors and staff, a way of saying goodbye to the old space. It's a sound you might recognize. We've been playing it all week as our audiograph mystery sound. We had some good guesses, and we'll tell you who won at the end of the show. But first, we want to share the story of the museum's newest bell. And don't worry, Brenda's bell didn't get the boot. It's just that the new museum is three times as big as the old one. So the Exploratorium commissioned a new bell to ring in its new outdoor space. KALW's Julie Kane went to the Crucible in Oakland to meet the man behind the museum's newest signature sound.
So this will give you an idea of what it's going to sound like. I'm going to ring it approximately where it's going to be hit, okay? So here we go. Nick DiFilippo. I guess what I am in terms of my work is I'm a foundry person. I melt metal and put it into holes that are shaped like things I want to make. I got onto bells a long time ago, so every once in a while somebody comes along and wants a bell, and it's an excuse to kind of take a little farther.
What are bells for?
I think in the West especially, where we think about either church bells or school bells or cities, fire departments or whatever. It's like, you know, something's going on. You want to get people's attention. I think what I've been trying to do with the stuff I've been developing is something that has a tone that I like, you know, something that you can hit it and just feel it and the sound, stand next to it. So it's more like a temple bell in that sense.
I like the idea so much of there being so much meaning in objects, and even meaning that, you know, it's this bell is going to be a very public object. At least the sound of the bell is going to be very public, and not everybody's going to know all of that meaning that goes into it, but it's sort of, I feel like it's present anyway.
I like the idea of the anonymity of it. I like the idea that there's this thing that's there and who knows who made it, who knows what happened to it. You know, it's just an object that's becomes part of its environment. Again, this is a different thing. This is a newborn and its life is ahead of it. And I know where to find it. You know, it's that this is one of my children that aren't going too far away, which is nice.
If you want to see how the Exploratorium's new bell was made, there's a video link on our website, kalw.org. And now, the moment you've been waiting for, get your bells out and ring them for this week's winner, Matt Golightly. Congratulations, Matt. We'll be sending you a KALW t-shirt. For the rest of you, there'll be another contest next week. In the meantime, go to KALW.org to hear more from Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. That does it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Alex Kaminsky, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Liz Pfeffer, Stephen Short, RJ Sloan, Anna Sterling, and Christine Stolakis. Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Thanks to City Car Share, which provides an alternative transportation option for our reporters. They're online at citycarshare.org. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio.
Pensamiento, dile a fragancia que yo la quiero, que no la puedo olvidar.
This is the new Bay Area band Los Trovadores. They perform Cuban son, danzón, and boleros, and they're playing acoustic dance music on Earth Day, which is this Saturday, at Rhythmics Cultural Works in Alameda. Music starts at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
Dile que bien suene ya, aunque no piense en mí. Pensamiento, dile a fragancia que yo la quiero, que no la puedo olvidar.